Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Amazon picks Boston for its first cloud security conference.
How do you secure massively distributed systems in the cloud? Huge challenge for people.
But what makes Boston a hub for cybersecurity? Also today, the push to make tampons and pads free in schools and public buildings.
If you're thinking about tampons as a healthcare product, it should be the same as ensuring that your school has Band-Aids.
And do we work too much? Some say yes, to the point that people are treating it like their religion.
Their desks have become their altars. When we worship work, we worship a god that doesn't care about us. We worship a god that has firing power.
We'll take your calls on how much work has become part of our identity. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let's begin today in the cloud, because Boston is a hub of a lot of businesses, including cyber and cloud security. It is such a hub, in fact, that Amazon chose Boston to host its first conference dedicated to cloud security, which is now going on at the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center. But what exactly is cloud security, and why is Boston a leader in it? Joining us in studio are two Boston CEOs, Tom Turner of BitSight and Sam King of Veracode. Tom and Sam, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Also with us via Skype is Joel Brenner. He's former Inspector General of the National Security Agency and head of U.S. Counterintelligence in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And now he's a senior research fellow at MIT. Joel Brenner, welcome back to you.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
Glad to have you. So Tom and Sam, I'm going to start with the two of you. First, when we say cloud security, that might sound a bit nebulous, actually, to folks. So what exactly does that mean? What does it entail? Tom, go ahead.
Well, I think it's important to demystify the whole idea of the cloud. The cloud is a way to deliver services that businesses run on in the same way that data centers used to do it in a more traditional environment. So all of the things that you would think about in terms of making your business safe, you have to do in today's cloud environment in the same way that you tried to do that in the more traditional data center and brick and mortar environment that that companies exist in.
So, Sam, what's a metaphor that the average listener who maybe hasn't run a business yet or works for their company and he doesn't have eyes into that piece of the operation? What's a metaphor that makes it easy to understand?
Yeah, so the way I think about cloud is that it's the great equalizer. And what I mean by that is that if you wanted to set up a business that's relying on software, that's relying on technology, you had to build up that technology stack and then think about running your business on top of it. What cloud providers do is they essentially give you that technology stack. They manage that technology stack for you so you can focus just entirely on your business and the value that you're bringing to your customers.
So where people might have thought of outsourcing, let's say, their janitorial services, now they're outsourcing their technology capability, basically.
You can think of it that way.
Okay. So, yeah. Tom Turner, why do you think that cybersecurity ratings for companies are going to be as important as credit scores in the future? You've made a bet on that. How come?
Well, I think, you know, if we think of how much of an impact a cybersecurity incident can have on a company and how top of mind cybersecurity is for organizations around the world, companies need a way to think about business impact and making risk decisions in the same way that they make decisions around credit, the way they end, where they make decisions about who they do business with. And you need to simplify that conversation. And so a rating in the same way that Moody's and Standard & Poor's makes it easier for an investor to think about whether they're going to invest in a bond or whether a consumer credit rating makes you a better or worse decision for credit or a credit card. Cybersecurity ratings are equally important when you think about choosing who you'll do business with, the companies that you are already using to build your business on, like an Amazon, or when you think of companies that you might want to acquire. A rating is a really important way to take what used to be a very technical conversation and put it in the realm of business where it can be understood by everyone in the organization.
To help me make...
Can I jump in here for a
second?
Sure,
absolutely, Joel, please.
In the interest of simplification and demystification, I think a lot of listeners need to understand there is no such thing as the cloud. There are lots of cloud services, and behind every cloud, there's really a clump. And the clump is a bunch of servers in a building somewhere. I agree with everything Tom and Sam have said, including the likelihood that we're going to see ratings. But people need to understand what we're talking about are the contracting out of communication services to different cloud providers who provide different kinds of services, which I'm sure Tom and Sam will be articulate about more than I can. But it's very important to understand there is no such thing as the cloud. There are groups of servers that perform services for other people.
Joel, that's really helpful. Thanks. Let's stay with that metaphor for a second, Sam. So we've got clouds and clumps, which for my simple mind, that works very well. This conference that Amazon Web Services is hosting here in Boston today and tomorrow, are we better at clouds and clumps? Is that why we're doing it here? What does it say about us that the conference is happening here?
So I think that it is not a coincidence that AWS has chosen Boston as the place to have their inaugural cybersecurity conference. So first of all, the cybersecurity conversation was rising in importance at their regular conference, which is reInvent, so much so that they felt they needed to have a dedicated conference on that. And the fact that they've picked Boston is a nod to the fact that we have a very thriving cybersecurity culture here and that we have a very thriving set of companies doing cybersecurity.
What does it mean to have a thriving cybersecurity culture? What is the culture of cybersecurity?
We have 30-plus degree programs that are being offered in cybersecurity across 18 or so universities in the Massachusetts area. Cybersecurity is a field that's really about keeping pace with technology. And if you're not training people on cybersecurity the way we are training a lot of people on technology, you're not going to keep pace with it.
All right. So, Joel, I want to come back to you. That was a really helpful description that you gave. So now that we understand there's not one cloud, there's clouds and clumps, we have to take that cybersecurity important. Why help our listeners understand, why do we need to care as listeners about cloud security in particular, especially if there is no such thing as one cloud?
Well, there are cloud services. And let me start this way. If you want to make your network secure, you really have to do three things. You have to be able to know for certain who's on it. You have to be able to know what is running on it. And you have to be able to know what traffic is moving through it. Very few companies do any of these things very well, let alone all three of them. And that's not the business that most people are in. This is a complicated thing, and people aren't able to manage their computer services any more than they could manage their own telephone services, if you want to take something much simpler. And so if that's not your line of work and you're not doing it very well, there's an enormous appeal of going to one of an increasing number of companies who will do many of these things for you. They can't do everything for you, and we'll come back to that later, but they can help you either by offering you infrastructure or a wide range of services and to run communications for you in ways that are more likely to be secure than you can do it yourself. This is very important.
So, Tom, based on that, so we've got businesses helping other businesses run their data through this more nebulous infrastructure. How vulnerable are companies and the average person when they store their data in the cloud? Can it ever really be safe?
Well, I think that it's important to strike a balance between being secure and managing risk effectively. You know, in the same way that all banks recognize at some point they might be the target of a robbery. Mm-hmm. I think all firms and, in fact, all individuals have to be comfortable with the fact that they will be the target of some form of cybersecurity attack. So it's really about how you manage risk. And so, you know, when you think of ways to build your business, for example, on an Amazon-provided cloud, or whether you choose to build your business in a different way, you know, you have to think about how you manage the risk of the choices that you make. And, you know, defense in depth is really important in the same way that you think about securing your house and mm-hmm. having locks on the door and alarms and greater levels of personal security. Exactly the same considerations have to be put in place, not because we live in a world where there will never be a cybersecurity attack.
Well, because we know there already have been.
We know that everyone will be the subject of one of those, whether by target or by choice. And so being able to sort of have a risk-based decision-making process. This is really important.
All right. So, Joel, let's go back to this idea of Amazon Web Services. And I do just want to disclose here, I have a brother-in-law who works for Amazon, and we try to be really clear about those kinds of things. Joel, they're putting on the conference, but they also, by some measures, are the largest player in cloud services. In 2017, they controlled more than 40% of the cloud market, and they run the back end of companies, everything people are used to, Netflix, Slack, Pinterest. In fact, they control more of the cloud market than their three closest rivals combined. That includes IBM, Microsoft, Google. Joel, does it concern you when so much of this one market is in the hands of one company?
Sure, it does. And I'm not criticizing AWS or Amazon for doing a very good job of beating the competition. But when we talk about security, we ought to keep three separate issues in mind. One is, when you have data in a system, you want to know, is it authentic? Is it confidential? Is it available? By authentic, I mean, has somebody mucked with it and changed it? By confidential, I mean, has somebody been able to see it or steal it? And by availability, I mean, is it going to be there when you want it? Now, cloud services clearly do better than almost any business on authenticity and confidentiality, but they represent for a business a single point of failure. And so the issue of backing up becomes important, and what you put on, what you do put out into the cloud and what you keep or back up yourself is another issue. Now, when you raise the issue of Amazon's 40%, the availability issue as a single point of failure becomes an issue for the whole country to think about, not just an individual company. Because if something were to happen to Amazon's cloud, if it were successfully attacked, then an enormous number of businesses would be unable to operate for however long that lasted. Or at least if, you know, I talk about attacking its cloud also is in different pieces. So the point I'm making is that extreme concentration is itself a vulnerability. This is a separate issue from what you might think of as the antitrust angle on this, of is somebody in a position of market dominance where they can dictate prices and so on. I don't think that's going on at all.
So, Joel, that sounds really vulnerable. I mean, that the single point of failure, you're kind of freaking me out. And Sam, Gartner estimates that companies in 2019 will spend $124 billion in data cybersecurity. Is it going to work? I mean, when companies spend all that money, are we going to be safe?
So that's a great question. I think it depends on how we spend that money and where we spend that money. And I think some of the security issues that arise are as a result of complexity. So on the one hand, I agree with what Joel is saying about there being the single point of failure or single point of vulnerability with AWS. On the other hand, there is a simplicity to their architecture because it's one architecture that applies across their cloud platform versus a lot of enterprises that are global in nature where they have a data center in one country, which is doing things one way, in a data center in another country that's doing things another way. So that complexity also introduces security vulnerabilities. I think it largely comes down to having a good understanding of what the attack vectors are. What do threat actors want to do?
You mean the attack opportunities?
The attack opportunities. Where are you most vulnerable? And I think it would be a mistake for any enterprise to think that just because they're moving their data and applications to the cloud, that they can rely entirely on the cloud service provider for security. It has to be a shared responsibility.
Okay, so I want to come back to Joel for just one more question here. Joel, you were at the NSA, and I want to ask you both, what is the role of government in ensuring security in the cloud and all of this? And frankly, can Congress keep up on the legislative and regulatory side? We've all seen the Facebook hearings. Seems like legislative leaders are out of step with technology. So what's your perspective there? Quickly.
Well, you've packed a lot into that.
I did. And I want you to do it all in like 10 seconds.
In 10 seconds. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Ability of Congress to keep up with the technology, not very good whatsoever. Although dealing with it on structural issues like, market share is different from trying to regulate technology. Technology moves fast. Lawmaking moves very, very slowly. I'm going to come back real quick to something that Sam was saying, which is that people need to understand that these cloud providers, however sophisticated they are, or even companies, BitSight and Veracode, can't do thinking for the company. They can help you enormously, but people have to think through themselves what they're going to do, and they have to govern. Security is not a purchase. It's a series of practices. And they have to do with organization in the company. Where does a CISO report? They have to do with HR policies of onboarding and termination and so on. Most of the problems we have aren't the technology. They have to do with bad management and with personnel practices. And the cloud services can help you deal with that, but they can't solve that for you.
That's Joel Brenner. He's former Inspector General of the National Security Agency and head of U.S. Counterintelligence in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, now a senior research fellow at MIT. Thanks for being here, Joel.
Great. Thanks.
Tom Turner is CEO of BitSight. Tom, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And Sam King, CEO of Veracode, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
There's more coming up on Radio Boston. Next, the teenager behind Brookline's push to offer free tampons and pads in all of its town-owned restrooms. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. When Sarah Graustra was a senior at Brookline High School in 2018, she wrote an op-ed in her school newspaper about the shame and stigma surrounding menstrual periods. Now she's a rising sophomore at Kenyon College in Ohio, but that op-ed was the impetus for Brookline to offer free tampons and pads in all of its town-owned restrooms. The Boston Public School System followed suit last week. It will now provide menstrual supplies to students in sixth grade and above. So we wanted to speak with Sarah Graustra about this and what sparked her op-ed in the first place.
I wanted to get the conversation started, and I was so lucky to have Rebecca Stone see this issue and be able to create an action out of it.
So Rebecca Stone is a Brookline town meeting member, and she led the charge in Brookline, getting the town meeting there to take up the issue. In May, Brookline unanimously voted to become the first municipality in the U.S. to offer free tampons and pads in all of its town-owned restrooms. That means town halls, libraries, rec centers. Sounds like you didn't imagine that would ever happen, let alone that it would go so far so fast.
I did not. Not at all. I'm very honored and appreciative of this project, and I'm really proud of Brookline.
Over the years, there have been a number of conversations about the hidden costs of being a woman. In your op-ed, you talked about a Huffington Post article that predicted that the average woman will spend about $1,700 throughout her life just on tampons, and that the total cost of a woman's period in her lifetime is more than $18,000, which is a shocking number. So who does this help economically to have free access in a community like Brookline or in the Boston Public Schools where they're going to begin to provide menstrual supplies for free in their restrooms as well?
It's just as much an economic issue as it is a social issue. This also relates to the fact that we think of these products as luxuries and not as healthcare products because they are so hyper-stigmatized.
Yeah, you write about the fact in your op-ed that personal care items, I didn't know this, like ChapStick and even Viagra are exempt from sales tax as healthcare products, but in many states, period menstrual products aren't. So do you think this would be, it would be that way if men also had periods?
There's a Gloria Steinem quote that if men could menstruate, they would brag about how long and how much. I think that the generations of perpetuated stigma that our society has seen around periods does come from its strong association with women. And even though women aren't the only people who get periods, it's that strong cultural association that has perpetuated that stigma over time.
The strong cultural associations that we have with women and their menstruation, you know, have led to so much stigma historically and around the world from you have to go live in a separate shed or now you can no longer continue your education or now you have brought shame to yourself and to your family. It seems that this movement to provide free supplies in public restrooms, in schools, et cetera, is partly to address the economic issue, but also to lower the level of stigma. How does it do that? How do we create a space where it's not a mark of shame for young women to have their bodies do what a female body does?
I think thinking about back when I was in high school, the norm was that if you needed to take a tampon to the bathroom, you would hide it in your sleeve and your shoe, which only perpetuates that deep shame that for many women comes with menstruation. I think the hope is that people who menstruate will feel supported, feel like their experience has been recognized by acknowledging it openly.
Sarah, Brookline is known as a fairly affluent school system. Across the country, we hear regularly about the cuts in education funding. Maybe we're losing arts or music or in some communities, maybe the library. So what do you say to those who will believe that the natural result of this is undue expenses, especially if there's a concern that people are going to hoard the free products for future use, which I have heard is a concern or criticism about this kind of approach?
I would say if you're thinking about tampons as a healthcare product, it should be the same as insuring that your school has Band-Aids. It just occupies a different sphere of importance.
Sarah Graustra is a student at Kenyon College in Ohio. In 2018, she wrote an op-ed for her school newspaper at Brookline High School about reducing shame and stigma around menstruation. Sarah, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
For more on this now, we turn to Jennifer Weiss-Wolf, who joins us from New York. She's the co-founder of Period Equity, a policy organization committed to menstrual equity and access to affordable and safe menstrual products. Welcome to Radio Boston, Jennifer.
Hi there. Good to be here.
Jennifer, you've said that you are so grateful to young people for making periods political. Is this a change you've seen just over the past few years, this activism from young people like Sarah over this issue? And what do you think has been the impetus for that change?
Well, yes, and it's amazing to see how this movement has it's just growing like, you know, just like wildfire, and it's young people and it's more mature people like me, and it's people just, you know, sort of from all walks of life really rallying around this idea that menstruation and being in the public sphere and being that there are policy solutions that make it inherently political, you know, that is a change. And it doesn't mean that we haven't been having periods forever, but the fact that we're talking about them so publicly now and that there are policymakers who are stepping up to address these issues, that is new, that is exciting, and that is just rocketing skyward.
So, Jennifer, within the past 2 months, the town of Brookline has said they're going to provide free products in public buildings. Boston has committed to free menstrual products in public schools. But New York City began offering free products in schools in 2016, and New York State later followed its lead in 2018 by offering products in all schools in the state. So where else, if anywhere, is following the Boston and New York lead? Where else in the country is this gaining traction?
it's actually gaining traction in major cities and states nationwide. So it's true. Here in New York City, we forged this legislation starting in 2015, actually, with sort of a wide-ranging group we call the Menstrual Equity Roundtable that represented all corners of the city. And the city's laws, as you suggest, included not just the public schools, but also shelters and correction facilities. And that legislation has been replicated now in places like Boston and Brookline, but also in states nationwide. So California, Illinois, and New York are three states that now mandate menstrual products be provided in public schools. And there are more than a dozen states that have done so for their both county jails and state prisons. Even this Congress, well, the 115th Congress in December, passed criminal justice reform legislation that was signed into law by President Trump. That is the very first ever federal menstrual access provision in the country, and it ensures that menstrual products are provided to women who are incarcerated in federal facilities.
So that gets to a question that's been on my mind. You know, we're talking about Massachusetts and New York. You mentioned California. I could hear listeners thinking that this is kind of the consummate liberal issue. Is it going to really gain traction across the country, or is this for the liberal states and urban environments predominantly?
I'm so glad you asked that, because not at all. This issue has such extraordinary bipartisan support. So Illinois, when Illinois both passed laws to eliminate its sales tax on menstrual products, the tampon tax, back in 2016, and then in 2017 passed a law to mandate menstrual products in public schools, those had both had huge bipartisan support and were signed by a Republican governor at the time. The tampon tax, the sales tax on menstrual products and the fight to eliminate it, is a campaign that has bipartisan support in every state. 32 states since 2016 have introduced bills to exempt menstrual products from sales tax, and five have actually gotten it done since that time. Like I mentioned, Illinois is one of them, and New York and Connecticut are two others where the bills were signed into law by Democratic governors. But Florida is another state that eliminated the tampon tax in 2017, and that was signed by Republican Governor Rick Scott.
So Jennifer,
I was just going to add that Nevada actually passed a ballot measure in November 2018, voted for across the aisle by citizens, eliminating the tampon tax, making it the fifth state to do so. So real bipartisan support, not just a blue state initiative.
Jennifer, there are a couple of states here in New England that are currently considering the tampon taxes or repealing it, essentially. Is that the case?
Yeah, actually two states where bills are still live, and people who are listening who are local in Rhode Island and Maine really can speak up and make a difference now. Rhode Island actually has a live budget bill that has been already voted on by the Assembly and goes to the Senate next that includes, for now, a provision to eliminate the tampon tax in Rhode Island. It would do it just for the duration of the budget, which isn't perfect. We would like this to be permanent, but some is better than nothing if this is all we're left with at the end of the legislative session. And that's live in Rhode Island right now. And then in Maine, the bill was passed by both the Assembly and the Senate to eliminate the sales tax on menstrual products. It needs to make its way through appropriations and to the governor's desk. And listeners can really put the pressure on now in both of those states. I'm part of a campaign called Tax-Free Period that is led by my organization, Period Equity, and the company Lola. And we have a website, Tax-Free Period, where folks can go to get all of this information, see exactly which legislators and the handles for governors to contact them and make their voices heard on this.
Yeah, Jennifer, just very quickly, you know, 20 seconds or so. This in New York, we've had a year now with them providing free supplies in the school systems. What has feedback been around cost and the trade-offs to not fund other things in the schools? What are you hearing? Very quickly, please.
Well, implementation has been a real problem, to be honest. These laws have been passed. They do not have budgets attached to them. So implementation has definitely been a challenge, and that is the next stage for this campaign.
Thank you. Jennifer Weisswolf is the co-founder of Period Equity, a policy organization committed to menstrual equity and access to affordable and safe menstrual products. She's also the author of Periods Gone Public. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, is work becoming a religion? We'll take your calls on workism. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
We know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Listeners, will you be taking vacation this summer, or are you too busy with work? Today, we want to talk about workism. It's a term coined by Atlantic staff writer Derek Thompson, who argued in a piece earlier this year in The Atlantic that work is becoming a religion for many Americans. Here with us to talk more about this is Dr. Jana Koritz, a psychologist and founder of Azimuth Psychological, where she specializes in entrepreneur mental health and burnout. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us on the line, Ellen Ruppel-Schell. She's a journalism professor at Boston University and author of The Job, Work and Its Future in a Time of Radical Change. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much.
And listeners, give us a ring on this. Do you think we work too much? Do you feel pressured to work all the time by a boss or coworkers, society, or maybe even family and life needs? Have you ever suffered from burnout, and did you cut back on work to cope? Do you let your work keep you from taking vacation? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. So thinking back to Industrial Revolution, people were required to work really long, hard hours. And then as they gained more money, values changed, different types of jobs came into the market, and family time became a little more respected as important. But it seems like the pendulum is swinging back with people dedicating too much time to work, sometimes maybe because they feel it's part of who they are. Ellen, how do we explain this move back to more work? And is there a difference between work and a job?
Well, those are a lot of very interesting and provocative questions. To begin, the whole notion of a job is a relatively new one, okay? As it was, you know, originally defined in the 16th century, the word job was meant to rob or to cheat. It was kind of a sordid bit of business, you know, meant to extract money from other people. So most people didn't actually aspire to even hold a job. Most Americans, up until the Industrial Revolution, which you just mentioned, were farmers. They didn't really have a job. They were entrepreneurs of a sort. They either owned their land and farmed their land, or they were tenant farmers or laborers on the farm, and these were not high-status jobs. So the whole notion of a job was not something that people actually aspired to. And, in fact, until fairly recently, the idea of working very long hours was low status, okay? It was not something that people really chose to do. And obviously, if you were poor and you had no choice, then you went along and did it. But people who could work shorter hours aspired to work shorter hours. So it's a relatively, two things, a relatively recent phenomenon. One, the notion of a job as a desirable thing to have as opposed to work. And the other is the long work hours becoming sort of a status symbol.
So, okay, Jana, sorry, please, Ellen.
Thanks.
So, Jana, Ellen, it's okay. Ellen just said that there was a time when a job wasn't something, sort of the idea of a job wasn't the thing that you aspired to. And I do wonder, is there a way to dedicate time to craft or passion without it having to be spending time at your job? Do your job and your passion have to be the same thing?
They don't necessarily have to be the same thing. I think what's difficult for a lot of the folks we see at Azimuth is they're in these high-pressure careers, and they're not able to find the time to do both of those things. And so they're spending, right, all this time at work. And if you don't like your job, let's say, or the way we define job now, currently, you're spending 40-plus hours, you know, our folks are spending 60-plus hours doing a job that they may or may not enjoy. And that's a lot. It's a lot of time to do something that you don't like or feel neutral about or even sometimes dislike. And I know my father's favorite ism was, you know, they call it work for a reason. And certainly you don't, I don't think there's an expectation or necessarily a good expectation that one should love their job and it should have to be their passion all the time. But it is a lot of time to commit to something that if you don't really enjoy or enjoy some of the time, you're going to start to feel that in a lot of negative ways.
So listeners, call in. Talk to us about this. How do you feel about your job? Is it the thing you get through to do what you love, or is it the thing that you love? You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Tom from Andover has called in. Tom, what do you got?
Hi. I just had a quick little thing. I work about like 40 or 50 hours a week and a full-time job, but I'm surrounded by people who work more than me. So just by me working like 8 hours plus a day and then wanting to go home, it makes me look like I'm somewhat lazy just because I'm surrounded by a bunch of workaholics.
So Alan Tom is feeling like he's paling in comparison, but he doesn't want to ride that train. Why do people feel the need to overwork? Where does that motivation come from?
Well, the motivation is an interesting word. Not all of us are motivated, but we feel that we should, just as that caller said. In fact, one relatively famous study talked about people at a firm that went unnamed who actually left their jackets on their chairs to make it seem that they were still at the office, even when they weren't, because they got the impression that everyone else was working 80, 90 hours a week. I mean, really crazy hours. So there, again, overwork, the notion of working long hours has become something of a status symbol. I mean, we kind of think of that as a good. Tell people I can't make it because, oh, I'm so important, I have so much work, I'm vital on the job, has become something of a status symbol. Not everyone really appreciates that, you know, or desires that. And yet, the other piece of why people work long hours is many people are dissatisfied at their job, as you mentioned. And ironically, more people are dissatisfied or less than satisfied at their jobs now than they were when many people work in factories. Part of the reason for that is that the idea that we have very, very high expectations of what our job should give us, not just a paycheck, but all sorts of things. And when those things are not delivered to us, some of us respond by putting in more hours. We blame ourselves for not having be satisfied by our jobs. And so we say, well, if we just put in more hours, the payoff will come. And, of course, that leads to a vicious cycle, right?
Yeah. Dr. Jana Koretz, and the people that you treat or that you work with, is what Ellen's saying, does that resonate? Are they happy but just exhausted? Or are they on a treadmill and it's not even bringing them joy?
I think by the time people come to us, it's more of the latter. Certainly there are folks who derive a lot of joy from their job, even if they're working 100 hours a week. And that's, you know, a small subset of people, I think. I agree with Ellen in that it has become a status symbol. And I think, though, the folks that we see, it's a lot more about identity, a lot more about the cultural pressure and norms that they're experiencing. I don't think that they necessarily work harder and expect more. I think they do expect a lot anyway, but because, you know, there are trade-offs and there's a reason why they're there in the first place. But a lot of folks have been on a trajectory. They've checked a lot of boxes and they've sort of thought that this is what they should or would like to do. And they are no longer able to sort of feel that anymore. It can be a lot of different things for folks, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But I think those are the folks we tend to see a little bit more of. They're stuck, but it's more of a pressure that is outside their control.
So let's talk to some more listeners. Casey from Quincy, tell us why you called.
I just called today because my work really is my passion. I love my job. I work in early intervention, so I work with kids 0 to 3 with developmental delays, and I love, love, love my job. But I'm actually in the process of looking for a second job because I don't make enough money, and I work a full 40 hours a week. So it's, you know, I think there's economic factors as well, where if people are working like an hourly wage, they have to work longer hours just to make ends meet. And especially here in Massachusetts, it's, you know, even with a two-parent income, it's impossible to survive. So I think that's an important piece of it, too, that people need to make money in order to survive.
So, Casey,
I understand the aspect of, yeah.
Well, you love your primary job, but because it doesn't give you what you need economically, you're going to have to take a second job. If it did give you what you needed economically, would you work those extra hours at the job you love, or would you use them for other things?
I would definitely. I mean, well, the thing is, I might use it for the job that I love, but my work is also very emotionally draining. When you talk about burnout, you know, my role is really to support a lot of families in many different aspects, you know, with their child's development. But oftentimes I'm wearing the hat of a psychologist, a social worker, support system. And, you know, sometimes I work more than 40 hours a week, but I get paid a, you know, standard salary. And for the work that I do, you know, I don't know that the trade-off is fair. You know, we're changing lives on a daily basis, and, you know, there's really no money in it, which is sad. But I would definitely put more hours towards my passion if, you know, it was balanced out with money and I wouldn't burn out so much.
Casey, thanks for calling in. I want to take another call from Stanley from Taunton. Hi, Stanley.
Yes, good afternoon. How are you today?
Well, thanks. Tell me what's on your mind.
What's on my mind about this topic about jobs is that, like me currently right now, I'm a public safety officer at the Jordan Hospital in Plymouth. It's a good job. It pays pretty well, but the thing is about it, it's very stressful. I've noticed that I've taken some of that work atmosphere or just being from work home, and it's been stressing me out. But at the end of the day, I just got to remember that with that job, I'm doing that job to finish school, to pay off school, excuse me, and to, you know, better myself and get myself in a certain position in the next 2 to 3 years. And I've noticed that with the situation that you guys are talking, or the topic you guys are talking about, how it affects you and if it's something that you want to, you're passionate about. In a way, I am passionate about it, but I know the reason why I'm motivated or passionate to go to this job every single day, not only to gain the experience of possibly being a police officer sometime down the road, it's to, you know, take care of what you need to take care of as someone in their early 20s to make sure that they establish themselves very well going forward. And that's what keeps pushing me. That's what gives me not a fatigue to start doesn't give me a certain fatigue going in, saying, oh, I don't want to be here. It's mundane.
So, Stanley, let me take it from there. Thanks so much. I find that really helpful because it raises a question. I'd like to take Stanley's comments, Dr. Koretz, and kind of bring them to you. What about people who, either because of their aspirations or school debt or a number of situations, they have to work a lot. They have to work a lot now. And so avoiding burnout might actually be a luxury for them. How do they cope with the exhaustion of working so hard?
Yeah, and that's a great question because for a lot of people, you know, our caller is talking about sort of a means to an end. But for a lot of people, there sort of is no end because they're supporting a family, let's say, or they have parents that have medical costs, they have their own mortgage to pay and things like that. And so they're not, you know, the high pace or the high pressure or the job that they have that's paying them to do that. They need to keep that along the lines, you know, for a long time, for the foreseeable future. And so what we talk about a lot is trying to, you know, not necessarily make drastic changes. You know, I think there's a lot of discussion of, you know, well, you shouldn't work 80 hours a week, you should work 40 hours a week. But for a lot of people, that's just not possible, like we're talking about. So how can you integrate things that are important to you? What are your values? What are other things that you like or would help you sort of take those moments or take pauses and sort of integrate those into your day-to-day life, depending on what that means for each person?
So let's hear from another caller after that. Sally from Sandwich, tell us why you called in.
Hi, yeah. So I think a lot of people, especially young people and millennials these days, they don't know how to talk to their bosses about time off. So they're kind of scared to actually take it, and they wind up not really doing it. I think a lot of offices these days, too, they have things like unlimited vacation. And then when you try to go and use it, it doesn't really exist. It kind of falls through. It's not there. And you get a lot of excuses from people in higher management as to why you can't take it that day, and then it just never kind of happens.
So Ellen, Sally raises an important point that I think we have to talk about, which is the role of employers. And we have a classic example of a boss making an employee run ragged. Let's listen.
Hi, I'm trying to get a flight tonight from Miami to New York. Yes, I know there's a hurricane. Yeah, sorry, hold on.
What?
Hello? Miranda, hi. Look, I'm trying to get you a flight, but no one is flying out because of the weather.
Please, it's just, I don't know, drizzling. Someone must be getting out. Call Donatella, get her jet.
Call everybody else that we know that has a jet. Irv, call every. This is your responsibility. This is your job.
Get me home.
Ellen, of course, that's a scene from Devil Wears Prada, where Andy breaks away from dinner with her father, frantically trying to get her boss, a very demanding boss, Miranda, an impossible flight back from New York. Now, that's probably a bit extreme. But how do employers contribute to workism and burnout?
I love that scene. It's great.
I do too.
And I'm not sure it's an exaggeration, actually.
Wow.
I think it's based on reality. So I'm sorry. I was just kind of entranced by that. So I'm sorry. What was your question,
well,
please?
Well, so how do employers – I know it is fun to get lost in those. How do employers contribute to burnout, to workism, to that be there, work, work, work?
Well, there's a bunch of different things. I mean, one of them is this whole notion of finding passion on the job, this idea that we all need to find passion. And as I mentioned earlier, that does encourage folks to overwork, even if they financially don't need to, okay? Because, they're looking for passion. They're told that there are intrapreneurs. I don't know if you've heard that word, but that's the idea of being entrepreneurial in service of an employer. So the idea that it's almost as if it's your own company, and so you're going to devote yourself to it sort of day and night to better the company, with the idea that the values of the company and the goals of the company are really your goals. And, of course, they aren't. And we have to keep that in mind as individuals. So on an individual level, how we can control this is to say, no, really, this is not my company. I will do a good job while I'm there for the appropriate number of hours. But I'm not going to delude myself into thinking the win-win for this company is always my win, too. It isn't always my win, too. In terms of employers, I think employers are getting the idea that working long hours does not necessarily mean good hours. And many people really can't be productive for more than a certain number of hours a week or a day. Some people told me it was really no more than 4 hours or 5 hours a day that people could be really productive. One study looked at people's work, working in offices across the country, and they found some people were engaging in as many as 50 meetings a week. I mean, that's really crazy, getting together with people 50 times a week in meetings. This was a terrible waste of time. So, again, I think management scholars are talking about how can we get control of this? How can we treat our workers' time, our employees' time, as not just a commodity that's endless, but something that's of value to both them and to us, and contain ourselves a little bit in the demands that we put on them.
So, Ellen, I want to move to a caller who maybe to this point about the number of hours worked, whether that's quality over quantity, and what option you have. Barbara from Westwood.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that over the last 35-plus years, I've been in computer system support, being on call 24/7, being a manager of a bunch of people, being woken up at 1 or 2 a.m., and the employer expected that Monday, Sunday, Tuesday, Saturday, didn't matter. And my last position was with a consulting firm. As I felt I was burning out, finally, after all that time, so I asked if I could go part-time. And as a result, they fired me.
Wow.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that, Barbara. And that comes back, Dr. Koretz, to this balance that we've got to strike between advocating for ourselves, our companies having expectations, but also us wanting to find meaning in our work. How do we find the balance between all those things in a way that stays true to ourselves but keeps us employed and keeps us thriving?
Yeah, and that's really the ultimate question, I think. It really depends on the person also and the company that they work for. Sort of like Ellen was discussing, I think there is a sort of a push a little bit to starting to think about or companies starting to think about their employees in a way that might be more helpful in terms of not just offering them food at work and ping pong tables and beer and whatever to keep them there so that people work for a long time, but instead, reaching out to
practices like ours and saying, hey, we want to offer, you know, mental health services or, you know, coaching for our employees. We are noticing that they're not being as productive as they used to be, and they are here maybe too much, and maybe you guys can help us with that. And so trying to sort of err on the on more of like a lifestyle or fitness or mental well-being perspective. But I think that's a really complicated question. I wish I had a really succinct answer for it, but it really depends on the individual, their values, their interests, their individual financial situation, their family. So I don't think I can say specifically what the answer is, but certainly it's worth investigating for everybody because that's really where the happiness lies in that balance.
So I want to bring in a clip of Derek Thompson from The Atlantic. He's the one that coined the term workism. And he talked to NPR's On Point about how we value work as humans and in our human interactions.
In D.C., the first question at a party was always, what do you do? In so many cities and in so many classes, the easiest way to learn about someone is to ask them what they do. It's a reflection of workism. It's a reflection of the fact that we have all quietly internalized the idea that the fastest way into a person's brain is through their resume.
Ellen, do we individually create pressure for others to have work define who they are? Is that a cultural problem for us?
Well, as much as I enjoy Derek's work and his thoughts on this, I think we have to be careful about generalizing. I think in some places more than others do we identify so strongly with our jobs. And in more rural parts of America, parts of, for example, Maine, where I spend my summers, right, the first thing that we ask when we get together is not, what do you do? What is your employment? People in Maine and other rural areas often don't ask that question first. Okay, it's considered rude. So I think the primacy of a job in our life is, as you mentioned earlier, a bit of a luxury in some ways for folks living in, you know, the East Coast or the West Coast or certain parts of the United States. But many people cobble together a life of work that does not necessarily even entail a single job. And that's, you know, something to keep in mind. We're all different, right? It's a very heterogeneous nation. But I'm sorry, your question...
No, that's okay. Let me stop you there because I want to turn to Dr. Okay. Koretz for just our last 30 seconds or so and just say, so based on that, as we look forward, what's important for us to value and do to find better balance and meaning?
I think that's an inward question for each person, you know, thinking about what each of us values as an individual person in terms of family. Is it our job? Is it the contents of our jobs? Do we like to be productive? Is it our hobbies? Is it our families? You know, what is it that's important to us that we want to be part of our lives and how we want to actually ideally spend our time? And then figuring out what is possible based on the realities that, you know, life circumstances and culture and your actual job, you know, things that, you know, might be actual constraints. And then if those things aren't aligned, figuring out, are there solutions to this? Are there, you know, alternatives that I can work towards and things like that?
Dr. Jana Koretz, psychologist and founder of Asthma Psychological, where she specializes in entrepreneur mental health and burnout. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Also with us on the line, Ellen Ruppel-Schell, journalism professor at Boston University and author of The Job, Work and Its Future in a Time of Radical Change. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
That's our show. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.